If the US dollar really was to reach an uncontrollable level of inflation, a last move by the Fed may be to do this same trade on a federal level by printing dollars to acquire bitcoins to stack on their balance sheet. Only time will tell. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Welcome back, everybody, and thank yourself for enrolling in the Bitcoin Audible University, where you will learn everything you need to know to protect yourself in our digital future and escape the sinking ship of fiat. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we've got an awesome read today. This is actually first-time author on the show. I think I've read a couple of pieces by him, William Clemente III. I hope I said that right. But I'll have a link to his social so you can follow him. He writes for Bitcoin RAR and Bitcoin Magazine on occasion. I'll have, a link to his social so that you can follow him on Twitter. But this is just a really cool piece about the state of the financial system and how there are actually multiple feedback loops, like feedback effects within the Bitcoin markets and the increasing financialization of these markets with derivative tools. And we're actually seeing the rise of true interest rates in the collateralized loan markets and how these things could actually steamroll hyper-Bitcoinization and why. So it's a really cool piece. Real fast, I want to remind you always, you got to be stacking with swanbitcoin.com/guy, and that's Swan spelled correctly with one N. Yes, it is your auto-buy, auto-withdrawal Bitcoin savings plan, and you got to hold your keys securely and independently, so don't forget to get your Bitbox O2 hardware wallet at guyswan, spelled like my name, with two N's, .com/bitbox, and then round out the full set, you gotta get Bitcoin-integrated mobile banking services with Level.co. That is LVL.co. Find all of these amazing services, our sponsors, at guyswan.com, and a huge thank you to them for making Bitcoin Audible possible. So without further ado, let's get into today's read, and it's titled The Bitcoin Black Hole Effect by William Clemente III. Our savings accounts can be thought of as the sum value of the energy output of our life's work. Inflation is a hidden tax on the common people, and is something you need to understand and be positioned accordingly as both an investor and citizen moving into the near future. Imagine the value of your life's work cutting in half every 15 hours at no fault of your own. This is what happened during the worst case of hyperinflation ever in Hungary, 1946. Given the unprecedented levels of money printing that have occurred in the United States since March of last year, why haven't we experienced a dramatic rise in the prices of everyday goods and services around us? How is Bitcoin the solution to this problem? What factors could accelerate this process? This article will answer these questions in vernacular that is easy to digest. What is hyperinflation? In layman's terms, inflation can be defined as a greater amount of money for the same number of goods and services. However, hyperinflation can be defined as inflation occurring at a rate greater than 50% a month. This means that by holding your wealth in a hyperinflating currency, the number of goods and services you are able to buy at the end of every month cuts in half. The only way to maintain purchasing power in this environment would be to own a scarce asset that is appreciating relative to that currency. As history has shown, this phenomenon is crippling to a nation's economy, as many participants are able to buy fewer goods and services, thus shrinking economic output. This shrinking in output causes businesses to cut back costs and ultimately a decrease in employment levels. A decrease in jobs leaves a surplus of demand for the available supply of jobs, meaning wages are bid down to the lowest taker, and many are left out of work. This is contrary to the current environment of growth we've become accustomed to, where growth funded by debt leads to increasingly more jobs. This increase leads to a surplus of jobs for the number of skilled laborers seeking them, thus causing wages to rise over time. We have established how hyperinflation would be detrimental to you, but why haven't we experienced it yet since March 2020, after historic levels of money supply expansion through quantitative easing and liquidity inserted into the fixed income market? To understand this, we must understand how we got to this point. Monetary policy backdrop. Following the 2008 debt crisis that brought the global economy to the verge of a deflationary depression, liquidity was inserted into the system to offset the destruction of value caused by the crises. Since then, this liquidity insertion, mainly taking place through quantitative easing, has been the main tool used to keep the economy afloat, along with the lowering of interest rates. By inserting liquidity through the bond market, the Fed is able to artificially inflate asset prices and other nominally measured values, giving the illusion of real growth. By lowering interest rates, the Fed essentially gives businesses a larger profit margin, which appears as economic growth, but in reality is just the decrease of interest rates. These two, quote, tools, QE and interest rate lowering, have been used alongside each other to artificially stimulate economic growth. This was until after the March 2020 liquidity event that forced the Fed to lower rates drastically, coming close to 0%, thus leaving them no wiggle room to use interest rate lowering as an effective method of stimulation moving forward. With businesses having to shut down due to the pandemic, revenues were unexpectedly dropped to historically low levels for many industries. This loss of revenues made it nearly impossible for some businesses to pay off their debts, especially given how little savings many businesses are incentivized to have. Rather, these businesses are incentivized, via inflationary monetary policy, to continually reinvest revenues into further growth instead of saving, which would lose spending power sitting idle. This loss of revenues created a shortage of dollars and put pressure on the Fed to provide stimulus relief. In addition to this, countries around the world flocked to dollars and treasuries as a safe haven during this time of panic. This massive demand for dollars needed to be offset by massive levels of stimulative liquidity insertion as well. With this massive demand for dollars, and interest rates 0.25% from zero, the Fed had no choice but to insert historic amounts of liquidity into the system to offset this deflationary pressure. In the chart below, you can clearly see the uptick in the value of the US dollar in March, thus indicating strong deflation. This is followed by a steady decrease in value up to today, as the Fed continues to insert more liquidity, inflating the dollar back to some extent of, quote, equilibrium. This insertion of liquidity weakens the dollar's value while increasing the value of assets measured in dollars. How much liquidity did it take to cause inflationary forces to outweigh the deflationary? The answer is a lot. Over the last 12 months alone, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet grew from $4 trillion to $6.7 trillion, or over 41% of the entire supply of dollars that have ever existed. The new $1.9 trillion stimulus plan proposed is greater than all the money printing in 2020 combined. This can be visualized below. Chart. This chart, as well as a few others earlier in this article demonstrating what William is going through. This is from the St. Louis Fed, and we see a dramatic uptick in the Federal Reserve's balance sheet in 2020. End chart. This is the simple reason why we have seen all-time highs in the stock market since March and a massive rally in housing prices. Liquidity insertion is the only rational explanation for the rallies seen recently in almost every asset, as they defied all logic for markets to have recovered so drastically during times of unprecedented debt levels and uncertainty for the economy. During deflation, the value of the dollar increases as the value of assets decreases. During inflation, the value of the dollar decreases as the value of assets increases. The indescribable amounts of liquidity cause asset prices to rise by default, given the definition of inflation is more dollars for the same amount of goods. Chart. And we just have another St. Louis Fed chart here of the M2 money supply since the 1980s, and yet again we see a significant uptick in March 2020 and continued growth from there. And funny enough, they just announced that they will stop tracking the M2 money stock, which is a pretty bad omen if you ask me. End chart. This increase in asset prices is the main reason we have yet to see broader inflationary effects to traditional indexes such as the CPI or Consumer Price Index. Rather than trickling down into the broader economy, money is being stuffed into assets. This can be illustrated by the velocity of money. The velocity of money is a measurement of how often money is changing hands. In the chart below, you can clearly see as the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet increases, the velocity of M2 money stock is accelerating downwards. This phenomenon has massive societal implications. It means the wealth gap is increasing, as the newly created money is put in the hands of the wealthy and stuffed into assets, never trickling down. At the same time, the average person with a savings account is getting their spending power diluted. This shows the paradox and hypocrisy of the Fed acting as if money printing benefits the people, but in fact has the complete opposite effect. Many of the social issues we have seen unfold in recent years can at least partially be accredited to decades of inflationary monetary policy causing greater wealth concentration. However, eventually, the newly created money will likely move into the broader economy over time as wealthy people sell assets to purchase goods and services. After all, assets are ultimately bought not for the ownership of the asset itself, but for the hope of being able to buy more goods with the appreciation and value of those assets. In addition to the QE that is being stuffed into asset market capitalizations, we have seen some UBI, universal basic income, as well. This is the direct insertion of liquidity into the hands of the people. However, we have likely not seen the effects of this either, as the uncertainty of the pandemic has incentivized austerity, not to mention the limitation of goods and services to currently buy. No travel, no dining, movies, shopping, etc. Once the uncertainty from the pandemic passes, we are likely to see the full effects of the money supply expansion as people begin to buy more goods and services. Now that we've established how high levels of inflation have a high likelihood of taking place, let's take a look at the solution. Bitcoin. Bitcoin's unique properties. Traditionally, the scarce asset of choice investors flock to during inflationary environments has been gold. That is, until Bitcoin was founded in 2009 as a 10x improvement on the properties that make gold an attractive asset to hold. Being a programmatic protocol existing through the internet, the amount of Bitcoin supply can be audited at any time by anyone. 18,600,200 at the time of writing. This makes it absolutely scarce. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins in existence, with the final coin being mined sometime around the year 2140. Another key aspect of Bitcoin that differentiates it from any other asset is its 4-year halving cycles. For simplicity purposes, we can describe this as the rate of supply of new Bitcoins being created is cut in half every 4 years. When these halvings occur, demand can stay the same, but price will go up by default. This initial impulse is what gives each Bitcoin price run-up momentum. This occurred in 2012, 2016, and most recently in May 2020. The chart above illustrates the supply of Bitcoin, the blue line, against the rate of new supply of coins, which diminishes over time, the orange line. Begin chart. This is, as I often say, the most important chart in Bitcoin and the heart of what Bitcoin is. This is a perfectly predictable, stable monetary schedule. It is the Bitcoin monetary inflation chart that we can see going out 100 years into the future and are able to determine what it will be roughly at that given time. If you have seen it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you haven't, follow the link in the show notes so that you can see it. End chart. This diminishing supply can be put into perspective by considering the following. There are 18.5 million coins after 12 years of existence, but the final coin will take nearly 40 years to be introduced into supply. This means you are measuring something becoming exponentially scarcer, Bitcoin, in something that is becoming exponentially less scarce, US dollars. Three factors accelerating Bitcoin's black hole effect. This effect is accelerated by several phenomena I think are worth understanding. The speculative attack on US dollars, made popular by Pierre Richard, the thesis of a new risk-free rate derived from Bitcoin, and the concept of lending over-collateralization that is an effect of seeking out this risk-free trade, both conceptualized and made popular by Preston Pysh. Pierre Richard's speculative attack. Speculative attack is the idea of leveraging the collapsing US dollar to acquire more Bitcoin early in the transition to this new system based on the Bitcoin monetary network. As Bitcoin appreciates in US dollar value, it makes the dollar-denominated loan taken out to buy the coins easily payable. This visual created by Croesus BTC illustrates this well. Chart. This is actually the same graphic that we, in the piece by Croesus that we read very recently, Asset DNA, explaining Bitcoin's speculative attack. So if you want to kind of get a deeper dive on this concept and a whole episode dedicated to it, it is read 493, and you can find it on bitcoinaudible.com and just search in the library. End chart. This concept has already happened in the case of Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy. Finalized on December 12, 2020, MicroStrategy issued $650 million of convertible debt notes at a 0.75% annual interest rate, using the capital to acquire more Bitcoin. Saylor effectively leveraged the depreciating US dollar to stack more coins on his balance sheet, which are appreciating. In my humble opinion, I see this as a genius move and one that others will likely copy in the coming months. If the US dollar really was to reach an uncontrollable level of inflation, a last move by the Fed may be to do this same trade on a federal level by printing dollars to acquire bitcoins to stack on their balance sheet. Only time will tell. Preston Pysh's yield spread over collateralization thesis. Recently, Preston Pysh has said that he's starting to think hyper-Bitcoinization might be less qualitative and more quantitative. In remarks he made earlier in the year, he often suggested that the breakdown in fiat would occur from an erosion of trust. This trust didn't have a numeric value, which makes it difficult to determine when such an event could occur. But based on his more recent comments, maybe it is becoming more quantitative. For example, during a recent show with Peter McCormick, he talked about institutional investors and retail investors alike being able to capture near risk-free returns in the Bitcoin derivatives market. Since Bitcoin is a very volatile asset, buying the underlying and selling longer-dated futures simultaneously provides substantial returns, especially when compared to any other financial market that's traded with this much liquidity. As an example of this, I'd like to reference a recent tweet from data analyst Willy Wu. Tweet from Willy Wu. Plan B quoted in a conversation we had. But right now, looking at my trade screen, $46,461 for June futures contract, $42,873 BTC price. Buy BTC, sell futures, I'm market neutral. I pocket $3,588 in yield, holding those positions to June expiry. That's 8.4% return over 4.5 months. End tweet. Unlike traditional debt markets, much of lending in the crypto economy is done with over-collateralization. For example, if a person wanted to borrow 1 BTC today, they might need to deposit 2 BTC worth of value while also paying a 9.75% annual interest rate. This over-collateralization process is, in effect, causing more and more Bitcoin to be locked into escrow, while also protecting the BTC lenders from default because the BTC markets trade 24 hours a day and 365 days a year. Now, it's important to highlight that not all lending and borrowing platforms are requiring over-collateralization today, particularly for institutional borrowers. But many suspect as prices become even more volatile moving forward, depositors will demand such over-collateralization to protect their funds. Unlike the traditional fractional reserve system that most market participants are accustomed to, the crypto economy is dramatically different. This shift to over-collateralize is how risk is reduced between borrowers and lenders. So if a person has a meaningful amount of Bitcoin, they can now borrow against that Bitcoin to conduct the risk-free trades described above in the futures market to keep adding additional yield to their portfolio. This appears to be providing an incentive structure to make Bitcoin even more scarce and sought after as, quote, perfect collateral with no counterparty risk and near immediate liquidity. In fact, this can actually be seen by current lending rates. Today, if a person were to deposit USDC onto a lending platform, the interest being paid is double that of Bitcoin. This is a crazy thought for people in the traditional finance world that view the, quote, risks of Bitcoin to be indescribably higher than fiat currencies. But here it is. On every lending platform around the world and in the free and open crypto market, lending rates for fiat, 9.6%, are higher than Bitcoin, 4.5%. An additional consideration when thinking about the implications of this long-short, near-risk-free investment strategy is that it becomes more lucrative as volatility and prices become more dramatic. This means more and more Bitcoin will be locked into escrow as the trade becomes more popular. Not only are traders implementing this strategy locking up the Bitcoins until the duration of the contract is complete for European-style contracts, but for physically settled exchanges, the escrow to write the contract is 100% collateralized on many exchanges. So if the spreads provide greater returns for longer duration contracts, those Bitcoin are locked up for even longer terms. Now, if this dynamic were true, we should see the open interest for such derivatives grow over time. And here's the chart. Begin chart. So this actually, if you go to the blockcrypto.com and select on data and the futures markets, essentially all of these charts just show a rapid increase from about September and October of last year into January and February of 2021. And in fact, just to get an idea, back at right at the beginning of November of 2020, the entire market, the entire open interest of Bitcoin futures was right around $4 billion. And right now, it is bouncing around between $16 and $19 billion, which is a 4 to 5x increase in just 4 months. I'll have the link in the show notes if you want to check it out. End chart. Given that coins are already being removed from the available supply, or off exchanges, at a record pace, this concept described by Preston Pysh will just accelerate the supply suffocation already occurring. The chart below illustrates the rate at which coins are already being withdrawn from exchanges, therefore not available to be bought. Chart. If you have not seen the Glassnode.com chart of the balance on Bitcoin exchanges and seen the incredible and persistent drop all the way back from March, April, and May of last year, and a drop which continues representing removing supply from the market, you absolutely need to. This is a really big deal, and we'll talk about it in the guys' take afterward. End chart. Bitcoin's black hole effect on asset prices. Another important point that Pysh discussed during the What Bitcoin Did podcast was this idea that lending rates will go higher. He suggested that as the price and volatility grows in magnitude, it could drive an influx of borrowing interest while also reducing Bitcoin deposits, thus driving the free and open interest rates into these markets higher. In fact, it could potentially set off a light bulb moment for traditional fixed income investors as they view the disparity between NERP lending rates and double-digit free and open crypto rates. This concern only becomes more likely as Bitcoin breaches $1 trillion in market cap and is taken more seriously by global banks, payment processors, and institutions alike. If such a scenario would play out, one can't help imagining the result it could have on discount rates and capitalization rates for equities, especially in a world where everyone seems to believe inflation doesn't exist and rates continue to go negative. Pysh used an example on the show where he suggested that if the market started to agree with USDC lending rates at 10%, that means equity PE ratios would need to be priced at 10 or lower to attract Bitcoiners out of their position and into stocks. As we know, current market premiums are priced at 30 to 35 times earnings today. So if such a scenario were to occur, it would reprice stocks at two-thirds the price of today in Bitcoin terms. Finally, let's not forget about the $120 trillion traditional fixed income market. What would it mean for that? Well, if the entire market is denominated in an eroding currency that the rest of the business world stops using to conduct economic calculation, I suspect it results in intense impairment for the owners of such financial instruments. All right, and that concludes the Bitcoin black hole effect. And it's a combination of ideas from numerous concepts around how the value is basically self-driving in the Bitcoin space right now and other factors that could contribute to this. And I want to talk about this for just a little bit, even though I'm a little late on time again. But let's go ahead and take a break and hit our sponsor, and then we will come right back. The first rule of Bitcoin is not your keys, not your coins. The second rule of Bitcoin is not your keys, not your coins. Bitcoin is a revolution in that you can securely and independently hold value outside of a political or financial institution. And the safest way to realize this is with a secure, easy-to-use hardware wallet like the BitBox O2. It is open source, Swiss made, a really sleek design, and it's even got a little screensaver with the BitBox symbol and it bounces around. And like an idiot, I actually watched it for like 15 minutes today waiting for it to hit in the corner because I watched that Office episode recently. But the backup process is on a micro SD card. It takes just a few seconds, and the BitBox app is as simple as it gets. If you have any substantial savings in Bitcoin, you need to take the next step and get a solid hardware wallet. Check out the BitBox at guyswan.com/BitBox. All right, so we start this out. This one's William Clemente, which we have not read anything from him before on the show, but I really liked this article. And then it hit on a lot of stuff that we've kind of, we've talked on in different aspects on the show before, but never quite all together, I don't think. If you want to dive a little bit deeper into a lot of these different concepts, I'll have I think probably three or four different episodes in the show notes that you can dig into. So he hits this off. Basically laying out the current conditions of the economy and the main data points that we know and we can pull from, which if we were going to state how the economy is doing right now, I would maybe characterize it as miserable. That's a pretty good, it's a pretty good word for it. But first we have the, with all the quantitative easing and liquidity provisioning that the Federal Reserve has done, we've had a massive increase in the money stock. M1 as well, but M2 more pronounced because M2 increases or includes debt instruments. And as he talks about with the low monetary velocity, money has not been exchanging hands. It's been accumulating in the people who get the money first, which are the wealthy. So the M2 money stock has absolutely skyrocketed. And there are a number of charts in this piece. I think I only kind of went into like half of them maybe during the read. So if you want to see these from the Fred, the St. Louis Fed, definitely check out the article so that you can kind of see these data points and the charts that go along with to kind of illustrate this. But since the M2 stock is actually not going to be recorded anymore, according to the St. Louis Fed, I haven't really dug more into this specifically. I don't know exactly, is this like across the board? Why is this decision been made? But this just seems like a seriously bad omen to me. You know, like this is kind of an admission of defeat in a sense. I think they just know the chart is going to look horrific going forward. And just like in good central bank fashion, when real data does not work out in their favor, they either change the calculation, see the political system and the CPI, they cook the books to cover it up, see quantitative easing, markets and asset prices, or they just stop reporting it because it doesn't look good. So this may be the last time we have data points on the money stock, and I don't think there's really any good way to measure that independently. You know, like banks would have to basically freely report that because a lot of it's behind closed doors. So I don't know if we'll ever actually have good data points on that. We'll see. I'm curious if anybody out there knows any other data points or something that does a good job of estimating or calculating the consequences of that. I'd love to hear about it because I've use the St. Louis Fed a lot, and that's an important metric, so might be gone. So we're actually already seeing the effects of the inflation, and this is even with the money velocity down. So one of the charts that were shown was how steeply declined the money velocity is, and the idea here is that they have issued massive, massive amounts of new debt and just flooded this into the financial markets in liquidity efforts to keep up, you know, repo markets and treasury markets and all of this stuff. And you know, their Keynesian analogy of we're going to keep the engine running. But instead, what's happened, this was to fuel economic activity, right? But because uncertainty is so high and debts have been so unsustainable. They've been using it basically to leverage and, you know, pay off the unsustainable debts that they had prior. And essentially the wealthy have gotten this money at no cost, and they've turned around and done, you know, things like stock buybacks to make themselves wealthier. And this is where we get insane PE ratios that he talks about, Preston Pish discussing later on, where equities develop this huge monetary premium and all the valuing models of stocks basically goes out the window. And, you know, the wealthy are all buying up real estate just to park value. So you get so much real estate that just sits empty. You get the same thing in commodities and treasuries, everything that the wealthy can get their hands on that will actually hold value for some period of time, because servicing the debt costs them nearly nothing, which was the whole point of issuing all this new debt, is because basically our previous liabilities were not fundable. They couldn't manage it. So it was either collapse or put in lower interest debt to pay off the higher interest debt. Well, because of this, it does almost nothing to produce, like, to boost actual economic production and, like, a healthy economy. And in fact, it does the exact opposite, right? It produces an incredibly unhealthy economy. It prolongs all of the misallocation that got us into this problem in the first place, and fuels massive stock market speculation and the paper economy. So food has real costs and diminishing returns. But if you buy stocks, there's almost no real costs in doing so and incredibly high returns. So why would anybody bother making food or toilet paper? You know, the economic incentive to produce the real things that we actually need to survive starts to get priced out of the market. It gets drowned out by empty asset price runs and paper returns. And this leads to people parking massive amounts of money, and none of it gets to the rest of the economy. But this also prevents the inflation from occurring in consumer goods until further down the line. Instead, we have an exaggerated short-term, really, really potent Kantian effect, where everything of real value and everything that sustains and increases in value in the long run gets completely priced out of the middle class and lower class potential. Like they can no longer access these things, and their retirements get obliterated because, you know, good luck with your Social Security paying for houses that go up 20% in price a year. But that inflation will come down the line. It's inevitable. It just takes a little while, but we're beginning to see it. We're already beginning to see it. If anybody's, you know, filled up your gas tank recently. In fact, I actually saw a thread earlier today, and I'm trying to hunt it down again, but I've not had any luck. I could have sworn I retweeted it or made a comment on it, and I'm not finding it in my list anywhere, and I'm not finding it in searches. I'm going to keep hunting, but it was really good. There was a bunch of screenshots of people getting, like, restaurant owners and, like, other people being told by their suppliers that announcing increases in price, like, one of them was, like, 5% across the board, all bread-related products or whatever are increased by 6%. And the range in conversation, like the thread, a lot of people were jumping in with other examples and how they've seen the exact same thing. And this was all really, really recent. And some of the ranges were pretty incredible. One even said that they'd seen products that have changed as high as 40% over the past like 4 to 6 months or something like that. But there was a lot of 5%, 6%, 7.5%, all of this range of just like prices going up. And like, feel free to send us any questions or concerns you have, blah, blah, blah. And like I said, anybody who's filled up their gas tank recently should notice that the price has risen. If you go back 6-7 months or whatever, I think it was like, I was seeing it regularly at like $2, like $2.02, like in my area. Now it's like $2.50, $2.60, somewhere around there. I mean, that's 25%, you know, and obviously it always fluctuates. And part of this is inflation, but I think a lot of it is actually, kind of the executive orders that Biden has done recently. I think he's done like 70 executive orders in a matter of weeks. And a couple of them have hit the energy sector in the U.S. really hard. Particularly, I heard something about Nevada getting just hit with some fracking thing specifically that was basically just made some subset of the work there basically just banned. I don't know any great details about it, but I know all the Green New Deal stuff that's going to be coming down the line. We're probably going to end up in a situation like France that's led to the yellow vests, and they had like the price of energy like double or triple or something. And some, I mean, the consequences over there have been staggering. And I think we'll probably see the same thing, even outside of just inflation in general. The access to energy will continue to increase and get worse. And as we've seen, like our infrastructure and the energy markets themselves have gotten more fragile and more poorly maintained because they age and we don't properly replace them. And basically, you know, like we have like this crisis in Texas where they've relied so much on renewables, and the renewables shut down when the snow comes through, and they've lost so many of their backup, like their gas overflow systems. And it just the whole, the conditions of all of it, it's just gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. And it's going to compound on itself as the costs go up and we aren't producing anything, and everybody's just chasing paper profits everywhere. So anyway, like regardless, just the fundamentals across the board, like there's a thousand things that you can point at as to why, but these are all just systemic issues that are playing out in a lot of different ways, right? And ultimately, the money is at the heart of everything here. And this is what we're seeing. This is the collapse of a society. This is an absolutely historic debt bubble. Finally, like every empire collapses because of debts. Like everyone, look at history. We learned nothing, and nobody's even stopping to think that like somehow it's different now. Somehow every single time that the major empires of the day have collapsed under their own financial incompetence and the debts that they ran up out of their hubris, somehow it's different now because we have fiat money. It's an embarrassment, but you know, I guess it's a cycle. And this happens all the time. Like this is across the board, and you get all the social unrest, you get the rising inequality. Like it's the same story over and over and over again. Like every book about history just has example after example, and you just read it and you're like, holy shit, this explains what happened last week. You know, like this is a perfect copy pasta of the conditions and the culture rot and everything that is going on today. This isn't a new story. This is the oldest trope in the book. Anyway, get ready. If you're not holding Bitcoin or some other hard asset, you are really going to feel the full consequences of all that poverty paper in the next year or two. And basically every metric is backing up that it's only going to get worse. And we've actually seen the 5-year, 10-year, and 20-year treasury yields start to spike, which very much suggests we're going to go back into really, really bad recession. And we're already there, right? You know, the holding on to some Bitcoin or getting exposure to Bitcoin may very well be a necessity soon rather than a, at least in my estimate, rather than a nice to have. But yeah, a little off topic from the article. Not trying to get all doomsday. I think, you know, if we properly prepare and we look at it, I mean, and remember, this is something that I've told people in the past. Like, I have a conversation like with my wife or my sister or whatever, and they'll be like, "Oh my God, how bad is it going to be?" And I try to remind them that, you know, this is a monetary crisis, right? Like, it's not like the factories disappear. It's not like we lose the ability to actually produce things, or like the labor disappears. Like, it's a monetary crisis. The ability to communicate value is breaking down, which means that if you actually have good money, you'll be the only one with access to the resources. And that's what I think we're getting an exaggerated effect in that, because Bitcoin is not only good money, but it's also one that is growing massively in the middle of just such an environment in which the bad money is getting worse and all of the bad conditions of that money are coming to fruition. You know, we're in the end game of Keynesianism, so to speak. So if you're in the Bitcoin economy, all prices are plummeting in relation to Bitcoin. We're seeing a massive natural deflation in the Bitcoin economy because the demand of trusted money, the demand of a sounder money, is skyrocketing at the exact same time that the supply is predictable. The supply is stuck right where it's always been, and it tells us exactly where we're going to be. There's nothing ambiguous about it whatsoever. But it sucks that the average person is, you know, kind of being forced into speculating on the stock market, like ignorantly. You know, people who don't know anything about the stock market are rushing to get in and buy equities and stocks. Then there might be like a really big crash. Well, maybe not. Like we saw in Japan and we saw in Germany, like during the hyperinflation of the German mark, is some part of the beginning. Like what really kicked it off is people thought they were making bukus of money in the German stock market because they were having massive returns. But they were having nominal returns. What they were actually doing is they were buying and selling a stock that was just matching inflation, and then they have a whole lot more marks, but then the marks started devaluing. Like you just don't want to hold the marks. But it makes perfect sense that this starts into, you know, everybody sees all these prices going up, and then everybody floods into the financial markets, get massively, massively bloated. In fact, another really great one is another great piece is a part of the Gradually Then Suddenly series, The Great Definancialization. I'm going to write that down so I don't forget it, by Parker Lewis. Such a good piece, and it talks exactly about like how bloated and overstimulated the financial markets and financial products and derivatives and liabilities and all of these things have become, specifically because the simple ability to you know learn a skill, produce on the market, and then save that, which is a huge risk, right? You dedicate years of your life and developing experience and skills in order to do this. This is one of the greatest risks of your life, is what you decide to dedicate your productive enterprises and your economic life to producing for the world. This is one of the greatest risks and investments we take in our entire life. And then it's stolen from us after we do it. And so the fact that you can't just save money and the value isn't bleeding, now we're also forced into becoming stock traders. Now we're also forced into becoming, you know, VC investors in order to just hold on to the value that we have already risked and we have already worked for and we have already earned. And that is going to unravel. But that's where we are right now. It was a really good quote actually by William in this piece. I singled this one out. It says, quote, "At the same time, the average person with a savings account is getting their spending power diluted. This shows the paradox and hypocrisy of the Fed acting as if money printing benefits the people, but in fact has the complete opposite effect," end quote. So this is the Keynesian effect, for those who don't know. And you'll hear about this from Bitcoiners a million different ways, because it is absolutely one of the most poisonous things, and it is where inequality comes from, and it is not a product of free markets. It is a product of a central bank, effectively socialist monetary system. But we recently talked about this actually in Read 489. This one was by CK, and I think he wrote it with somebody else, and I can't remember it off the top of my head. I'm sorry to whoever that else that was. But a Christian, CK Snarks, it's called the Keynesian Effect 2.0. read 489, and I'll have the link to that in the show notes. But it's exactly how, like, the fact that someone is issuing new money, whoever gets that money first gets essentially free or incredibly cheap access to trillions in new money, and they use it to bid up all of the really valuable goods in society, and it makes them unreachable to the average person. You want to own a house? Guess what? It's going to get 20% more expensive every year. The most critical shelter, literally a food, water, shelter is going to get continuously more expensive every single year because it's actually a valuable, scarce asset. And it's one of those things is that the mental framing of trying to wrap your head around what that looks like under a sound money economy, you know, I have people ask me, it's really difficult. I have people ask me all the time, how do you afford a house if you can't go into debt? And I'm like, well, the cycle of cheap debt to buy a house so that the house goes up in price so that you can afford the debt, that's why it's so hard to afford a house to begin with. If the house price fell every year, then only people who bought houses because they needed a place to live would buy the house. So you can't take the consequences of a debt-based fiat market and then ask how you would deal with those consequences in a naturally deflationary sound money economy, because it doesn't exist in a naturally deflationary a sound money economy. Nobody's going to buy up, like, a third of the real estate around Manhattan sits empty because it's just rich people parking value. Do you know what that does to the price of housing, to the price of rent? There is a massive monetary premium on real estate that does not need to be there. And it is directly tied to our homeless problem, because it's incredibly difficult to afford shelter when people are using it to park billions of dollars in value and leave it empty. It's a consequence of our money. And, you know, since I brought up deflation, and William talks about this, because this is something really important to point out, and a lot of people don't understand this, but, like, William talks about it in this piece correctly as a negative thing, right? But that's because we're talking about debt deflation. This is very different from natural deflation, and most people do not understand the difference in those contexts. So debt deflation, let's try to just do an example. Okay, so there's 100 people, and let's say half of them or more are broke and jobless. We got 100 people, and they can't really afford anything, but we've got 50 brand new iPads. You know, Apple releases some new iPad, and there's only 50 of them. All 100 just got issued a credit card, and almost all of them couldn't afford it. You know, everybody's doing this on debt. They don't actually have the money to buy this iPad, but they all have credit cards. So they all rush out and buy the iPad. And the people who could actually buy the iPad at $500 now have a credit card to bid it up to $1,000, because there's 100 people chasing the iPad, even though there's only 50. And even though a ton of them can't afford it, they're able to put it on their credit card. So the iPad gets bid up to $1,000, and the people who could afford $500 now have to pay $1,000, and everybody who couldn't afford it has put, you know, $1,000 on their credit card. So during this part, This is the first stage of a debt bubble. This is what is when the economy looks like things are great, right? Apple reports huge numbers. They've issued a whole bunch of new Apple cards to customers. Revenues are high. The money velocity is high. The whole works, right? Everything looks beautiful. Politicians are bragging about it. Apple hired a bunch of new Apple geniuses. Blah, blah, blah. Happy days. Well, now the bills start coming due. Maybe they get, you know, 0% for like 3 months, and, you know, everybody kind of squeezes by and they just barely get by. But now the monthly bills start coming due. And after about the fourth or fifth month, a bunch of people can't make a payment. Now they got the interest coming in full, and now they get a penalty They get a penalty on top of what they owe, and their interest rates go up. Then after a year, everybody's just barely squeezing by and stretching it as far as they can. But because everybody's maxed out their credit cards, Apple sales go down. So they have to fire a couple of their Apple geniuses. And after a year, it becomes clear that more than half of this debt is about to get obliterated. And tons of them try to save themselves by selling their iPads in the secondary market to try to escape from underneath, or at least fund a little bit, pay for a little bit more of their credit card before, you know, they basically become destitute. So the price falls to $75 an iPad because everybody's dumping their iPads onto the market. Apple's not selling anything anymore. And a bunch of the people have to default on their credit cards. The cards get frozen. 2/3 of the original bills don't get paid. And that's because not only could half the people not afford it, but the people who could afford it had to pay a much higher price that they couldn't afford just to get the iPad because the prices were bid up. Everything was a hugely inflated price, inflated markets, everything. This is the debt deflation scenario. The prices collapse now in the market. The amount of debt collapses, you get defaults, and actual money supply disappears from circulation. And this is horrible because now the price of iPads, which were $1,000, rather than correcting back to the natural $500, plummet all the way to like $100. And this is kind of what we see in the housing markets, is you get this exaggerated effect because you had such an exaggerated market going into it. And rightfully so, economists recognize this as a terrible thing. This is the horrible fallout of a debt-based economy paying the price of a lie, of a manipulation about the price of debt. So when an economist tells you, oh, deflation is the devil and you could never have an economy work on it, well, that's because we're drowning in debt. And they're absolutely right in the current situation. But it's also because they're stupid and they can't think of a world that's not run on their disaster of a fiat liability-ridden system. Natural deflation, on the other hand, is what we got during the Industrial Revolution. From like the 1870s to maybe the beginning of the 1900s, which was actually one of the greatest sustained increases in living standards that this in the U.S. entire history. And it was when we were as surely on the gold standard as we ever were. And that is natural deflation. And it's produced by the simple truth that if we can make 10% more stuff after a year of building machines and factories and innovating and making new processes and, you know, turning what was a manual chipping process into a molding and stamping process, so we can produce 10% more stuff, but we have roughly the same amount of money in circulation, everybody's wages can buy 10% more goods. That's natural deflation. So you get paid the same $1,000, let's say your monthly salary is $1,000 one year, and it costs you $500 for all of your groceries. But 5 years down the road, there's massive economic progress, innovation, we keep producing more things, our machines get better, we put more robots to work. Now, that same $1,000 5 years later, it now only costs $250 for the same amount of groceries, and you actually get higher quality, cleaner food. That is natural deflation. The value of your money just doubled. The debt deflation scenario is when overinflated prices get overcorrected because of an imbalance. A natural deflation scenario is when everybody gets more productive and we all share the rewards of that extra productivity. It's important not to confuse the two. The debt deflation scenario is destructive and it's representative of a massive correction in a broken market. The market trying to heal itself, and that hurts very bad, while the other is extremely desirable, and it is exactly what you want to happen when everybody gets wealthier. We all become more efficient, We all get more leisure time. Our wages go further. Our ability to quit a job that's treating us badly and go to a better, higher standard job with air conditioning and better hours and better vacation time gets easier and easier. That is the natural deflation. And that not only do we definitely want that, we don't want an economy that does anything but that. That's the whole point of an economy. If you don't get the reward of being able to make more stuff and having better quality stuff, why the hell are we doing it? It's not like we go to work just because we like to work. The point is to make your life better. Thank God we actually have Bitcoin to potentially transition us, which is what we are seeing, back to real prices. And now this is, God, I've already gone too long. This is where the really interesting thing happens. And I really want to, I actually reached out to Preston Pish to come on the show because I want him to break down this concept of the over-collateralization and the real interest rates. Because this is something that I've been thinking about for a while, but I don't think I know the intricacies of the debt markets and the collateralized loan markets well enough to kind of articulate this right now, but I want to do some digging. I'd love to be able to ask him some questions about it. So if you want to bombard him on Twitter and help me out to get Preston Pish on the show, I would love you. You know, don't annoy the snot out of him, but you can pester him a little bit. But the fact that we'll actually get, like, we have horribly manipulated interest rates right now, right? And the price of time is one of the most critical prices in the economy. So if you manipulate the price of the interest, the price of time, the price of capital that you spend today versus actually producing and saving for the future, you manipulate and corrupt the value of everything. Everything is dependent on the price of time. The interest rate is one of the most important prices in the economy. And you just screw up everything if you just start arbitrarily dictating what that is. So, and even more is that the interest rate cannot go up. This was actually for the U.S. government, it cannot go up. There was Nick Carter, I got it right here somewhere, tweeted something out about the Macro Voices podcast that I haven't listened to yet, but I've got it in my lineup now. Okay, here it is. My mind was blown. This is Nick Carter, by the way. My mind was blown when I heard this from Louis Vincent Gav on Macro Voices. In one stat, why the U.S. government cannot afford for rates to rise. So, quote, this is Louis Vincent Gave. I don't know how to pronounce that. Well, I think a lot of that will depend on central bank policies. Central banks at some point, you know, as bond yields inch higher, which they are doing, will have to make a choice of either, you know, fully embracing yield curve control and in essence crushing our currencies in the process, option one, or letting the bond yields go back to natural levels. But in doing so, you know, really putting pressure on the government, to put things in context, a 50 basis points, that's 0.5%, by the way, basis points is 1/100th of a percent. Basis point increase in the cost of funding for the U.S. government is equal to the cost, the annual cost of the U.S. Navy. 30 basis point increase is equivalent to the cost of the U.S. Marine Corps. So basically a 0.8% increase is the U.S. Marine Corps and the U.S. Navy together just in interest payments. Back to the quote. So, you know, just going from 50 basis points to 230, that 80 basis points, 80? Must be 130. Yeah, it's supposed to be 130. That 80 basis points is equal to the Marine Corps plus the Navy together, the annual budget. So I wish I had the answer, of course, and I'm not trying to duck away, but the simple reality is it will depend on what central banks decide. Do they do yield curve control and crush their currencies or not? And that is basically where we are. That's the situation we're in, is do we obliterate the U.S. dollar, or does the cost of the U.S. government just absolutely skyrocket? And we can't afford anything, or I don't see how they raise interest rates. I don't see how this is either a economic catastrophe or a monetary catastrophe. Either the economy is going to be destroyed or the money is going to be destroyed, which, and It's the same thing. Like I don't, there's no easy way out of this. There's no easy way out of this. The least painful way is to let markets adjust. But it literally means that the political system gives up all its power. So, you know, if you think that's going to happen, unfortunately, I don't. I think basically, yeah, either way, hold Bitcoin. Like, you want to get out of the financial system. You want to hedge against the currency. You want to stay out of bond. You just want to stay out of everything. It's just, I can't imagine doing anything. Like, I got to get off the boat first. And then I'll see if, are they going to sink? Or are they going to float? What are they going to do? Yeah. Thank God for Bitcoin, right? Well, with that, let's go ahead and close this one out. Thank you guys so much for listening. A huge thank you to our wonderful sponsors, the Bitbox hardware wallet for your cold storage, Swan Bitcoin for your Bitcoin savings plan and auto withdrawal to your cold storage. Don't even have to do anything. Set it and forget it. And then, of course, Level Mobile Banking Services. That's LVL. These are the Bitcoin products to put your Bitcoin life together securely and hold your own keys. And Bitcoin Audible is where you get the ultimate education and entertainment. I am Guy Swan. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.